Is your nuclear policy dead? Where is the nuclear policy up to? So where is your nuclear policy now? What do you understand about the science of climate change? You accept the science of climate change. How important is it to get to net zero as quickly as possible? You will not withdraw from the Paris Agreement. You will not cut loose the net zero target.
Welcome to the Baseload podcast. My name is Ben Beatty, and I am sceptical of many things, including the impartiality of the ABC's Sarah Ferguson, who interviewed Ted O'Brien, now the LNP deputy leader, just days after the May federal election. In my opinion, Ted didn't handle this interview as well as he might have. And I also believe Ferguson got exactly what she wanted out of the 8-minute segment. What she got was Ted conceding all LNP policy is up for grabs.
No policy is definitively in or definitively out.
And that Ted is desperate to avoid being labelled a climate denier.
Oh, look, I think it's critical that we reduce emissions as quickly as possible, but it has to be done in a balanced way, Sarah.
Now, call me naive, or maybe a right-wing nut job, whatever you like, but appeasing the climate alarmist, the RE lobby and its sycophants, doesn't appear to have worked very well for the LNP to date. And perhaps it's better to lean into the name-calling and the labels, take it head-on, take the sting out of it, and actually create yourself the elbow room to make an argument. Okay, this episode I compare Rio Tinto's statements on the Tomago aluminium smelter electricity price troubles. I explain why, in my opinion, renewables cannot reduce wholesale electricity prices. AEMO's dropped a report saying their estimates for transmission costs are way undercooked. Even the media noticed that one. And the GOAT takes on, guess who? Energy Minister Chris Bowen. Can't get away from the guy. Love him. The interview this week, Matt Canavan. Now, picking up from my comments at the top of the segment on Ted O'Brien's interview, some will point out here that the LNP lost a bunch of seats, and that was because the LNP did not push renewables more strongly, but I think that's inaccurate. The federal LNP has had a net zero policy under all leaders since Turnbull took over from Tony Abbott, basically. To date, only the Morrison government has published a net zero roadmap. As far as I can tell, Labor has not. Please correct me if I'm wrong about that. TheBaseloadPodcast@gmail.com. The Morrison roadmap contents page makes me deeply, deeply afraid that anybody would even attempt such a thing. The plan goes something like this. It talks about part one, Australia's approach and principles. Part B, Australia's plan, driving down the costs of low emissions technologies. 3, enabling deployment at scale. So, electricity, transport, buildings, agriculture and the land sector, industry, mining and manufacturing. The role of offsets in achieving Australia's net zero goal. Chapter 4, seizing opportunities in new and traditional markets. Chapter 5, fostering global collaboration. Part C, looking ahead, an adaptive plan for the future. This is terrible.
Our goal is to reach net zero emissions as soon as possible, and preferably by 2050.
So obviously that's Scott Morrison sometime after the 2019 election and before the 2022 election, when no one actually heard from him again. What has Anthony Albanese had to say about net zero? Well, here he is at the press club in January 2022.
The country that uses its abundant natural resources to drive new industries and become a renewable energy superpower, creating jobs as power prices fall and writing a new chapter in Australia's proud energy story. Our Powering Australia plan will reduce Australia's emissions by 43% by 2030, putting us on track for net zero by 2050. It's a plan with economic growth at its heart. Over 600,000 jobs created, $52 billion of private sector investment, spurring new industries and cutting power bills by $275 by 2025 for the average family.
Well, we all know how that went, but here we are in 2025 and Anthony Albanese at his election victory speech.
Together, we can end the climate wars. Together, we can take advantage of the opportunity for Australia to be a renewable energy superpower. Together we can work in common interest with business and unions to drive productivity, to lift wages and profits. I want an economy that works for people, not the other way around.
This stuff is all quite exasperating to me, but what does help is Chris Uhlmann speaking with John Anderson on the John Anderson episode. Check it out on YouTube. Here's an example.
Because I met a very senior official over a cup of coffee not long ago in Sydney. But I said, I've got some quite deep concerns about what we're being told by your organisation. I was flabbergasted when he said, so do I.
I've had the same conversations with people who run electricity retailers, for example, and the people in the industry who know that we're on the wrong path, but all want to sign up for a target like net zero because they feel that their shareholders want it or that the public wants it. And the public may well want it. What people need to do is to tell them the truth, that if we continue on this path, it's going to be very expensive.
You will not withdraw from the Paris Agreement. You will not cut loose the net zero target.
Unless you're living under a rock, perhaps eking out a skimpy, scant net zero existence, heaven forbid, you would have heard that Rio seems to be complaining about the cost of electricity, specifically for their Tomago aluminium smelter in New South Wales. In August 2024, the CEO, Jakob Stausholm, had this to say on the ABC.
I have a headache.
It might be a tumour.
It's not a tumour.
Sorry, wrong clip. I've been trying to get Kindergarten Cop into the Baseload podcast for a while, and there you go. Okay, here's the real CEO.
We have signed up for billions and billions of dollars in terms of PPAs for underwriting the development of the biggest solar farm in Australia and the biggest onshore wind farm in Australia.
How many dollars have been handed over in PPAs to wind and solar farms by Rio?
Billions and billions and
billions and billions and
billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and
I've used Trump's billions and billions before. It's on YouTube. It goes for about 2.5 minutes. It's great. Okay, so that was August 2024 from the CEO. Now, in a few weeks later, in September 2024, the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer, Andrew Newman, released this hostage video, a internal promotional video explaining how well they're going to do sourcing renewables.
Hi everyone, thanks for tuning in to the latest update on Tomago Aluminium's Repowering the Smelter journey.
Yeah, g'day Andrew. What do you reckon about the price of electricity at the moment? Is it good or bad?
The price of electricity on offer now is higher than where we need it to be.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Andrew. What do you think you'd be able to do about it?
We're eager to work with our partners to secure the best possible outcomes for our renewable energy transition.
Oh, okay. It sounds as if you're telling me that you're going to continue pursuing renewables to power your aluminium smelters. Is that correct?
Another key finding from our process confirms that our aspiration of a 100% renewable power supply by 2035 is a very achievable reality.
Hold on a minute. I thought you just said that electricity costs are very high.
However, our goal of achieving greater than 50% renewable energy by 2030 will be challenging.
100% renewables by 2035 is completely achievable, but 50% by 2030 is challenging. Did I hear that correct?
100% renewable power supply by 2035, very achievable reality. Greater than 50% renewable energy by 2030, challenging.
Okay, so assuming you're at some percentage of renewables now in 2025, not zero, that means that you've got less than 50% to get to in the next 5 years, and that's challenging. But getting from 50% to 100% in the next 5 years after that is a certainty.
Very achievable reality.
Well, okay, I guess if you say so, you're the expert.
Our commitment to a greener future remains unwavering.
Yeah, that's a great motherhood statement. Congratulations. I can't label you a climate denier, but what are you really going to do? How are you going to even move forwards on this program?
We're committed to working closely with proponents and stakeholders, including all levels of government, to ensure continued progress on our renewable energy journey.
Okay, backing off the cynical sarcasm journey we just went on there. Stepping forwards to November 2024, And we have this from Sky News.
Very tough words today from the boss of Australia's biggest electricity user. This is Tomago Aluminium. The company says its goal of switching to mostly clean power by 2030 is not achievable. It's blaming increasing costs and concerns over intermittent supply as the grid moves towards wind and solar.
Okay, that's quite a journey from August to November. Then we have on June 6th, 2025, in the AFR, a story with this amazing headline, Rio pushes for eye-watering Tomago bailout. In the text, Tomago Aluminium Smelter, the nation's largest electricity user, is in urgent talks to secure billions of dollars in support from the New South Wales and federal governments to save it from collapse due to crippling energy costs. Sources familiar with negotiations but not authorised to speak publicly told AFR Weekend discussions are focused on the smelter's electricity contract for 2026 to 2029 and the design of the federal government's production tax credits.
We're committed to working closely with proponents and stakeholders, including all levels of government.
It doesn't come for free, but it should lead to that we have competitively priced energy and therefore can continue to produce aluminium in Australia.
You will not withdraw from the Paris Agreement. You will not cut loose the net zero target.
On the 22nd of May 2025, AEMO, the Australian Energy Market Operator, released a report. They called it Draft 2025 Electricity Network Options Report. Here's the ABC's Alan Kohler on the 1st of June, explaining some of the problems this report exposes.
The cost increase in 2 years for 10 transmission line projects, the cost increases range from 11% to more than 60%. The average is 31% in 2 years. No one wants power lines across their property. Last week, the energy regulator increased electricity prices, and a lot of that was due to rising transmission costs.
Goodness me, Mr. Kohler sounds surprised. Well, if he'd been listening for the last couple of years, he would have heard people like myself, Aidan Morrison, Chris Yeoman, any other person on that side of the argument saying pretty much exactly the same thing, that it's all going to cost way more and take a lot longer than we are being told by the bureaucrats. At least AEMO has finally produced some evidence. I spoke to Damien Currie on his show The Other Side about it last week.
Now, you don't hear the ABC doing much reporting on the negatives of wind and solar power. So Alan Kohler was brave to even get this report out, I reckon. All right, well, our energy guru, electrical engineer and host of the Baseload podcast, Ben Beattie, joins me in the studio. Ben, welcome back again. The cost is going to be prohibitive, Alan Kohler says. Why isn't this front page news?
That's a good question, Damien. Thanks for having me back. This is just another subsidy contributing to the structural challenges that our energy system is facing. So it's probably not front page news because, you know, politicians and governments throwing a couple of billion dollars around is not big news anymore. We're used to it. We're desensitized to it. And the voters, there's a certain demographic of voters who will appreciate it. A lot of us will look at it and go a little bit skeptical of, is there going to be any improvement? But yeah, big costs in transmission blowouts in the transition that we told we need, regardless of the cost now, apparently, and more subsidies for people who can opt in to
this
those
fundamental
benefits.
Stuff, though, right? If they can't get those transmission lines built at a reasonable cost, then it's game over as far as getting the electricity from the wind and solar factories into the cities.
Yeah, indeed. So if the no matter what subsidies and programs, for example, the capacity investment scheme that the government comes up with to incentivize developers to build new wind and solar projects out in the regions, if the transmission's not being built, then they won't be able to connect to anything. Therefore, they won't be able to get the finance to build the projects. So in my opinion, I think the government, the Chris Bowens, et cetera, are going to be focused almost relentlessly on the transmission. And unfortunately for us as taxpayers and consumers, they're going to do that regardless of the cost. They've got targets, you know.
Okay, back inside the safe space, that is the Baseload podcast studio headquarters, whatever you want to call it, we have this extract of an interview between Ross Greenwood on Sky News and AEMO's CEO, Daniel Westerman. This interview occurred, let me look it up quickly. This interview occurred on the 28th of June, 2024.
What this plan lays out is obviously the lowest cost pathway to meet Australia's energy needs.
It's a shame that Ross Greenwood didn't have access to Daniel Westerman's Hansard statements in one of the energy inquiries that began in November 2024. Here's what Westerman said about the ISP on Hansard.
The ISP is not a tool to evaluate government policy.
So just to make it ironclad clear here, if the ISP, the Integrated System Plan, if AEMO does not evaluate government policy, how does it know if it's cheap or not? Yeah?
Their lowest cost is renewable energy, backed up with what we call firming, so, you know, batteries and storage, but ultimately backed up by gas, flexible gas power generation.
This is a very strange contradiction that we find ourselves hearing, that renewables are the cheapest thing going, and yet our power bills keep going up. The future is everything and gas, but the future is meant to be net zero, no fossil fuels at all. I don't know. I'm just a dumb engineer. I'm a bogan, a redneck with a degree. What am I to make of all this stuff? What does he say about transmission?
You highlight transmission, and we are highlighting consistently, I would say.
Billions and billions and...
Hang on, wrong clip.
The cost increases range from 11% to more than 60%.
Wrong clip again. Hold on, let me find the right one.
Hi, I'm Steph Jolly. I'm the General Manager of Market Performance here at the Australian Energy Regulator. The way we set the DMO is that once a year, we take a really close look at the costs in the electricity supply chain. So we build a cost stack model, which means we're looking at the cost of generating electricity, transporting it through poles and wires, selling it to customers, and then we allow a profit margin on top of that.
I can't believe this keeps happening. I keep getting the wrong information out there. Sorry, Daniel. I'll get it right this time, I promise.
Benchmark power prices in the state are set to rise by almost 10% in some areas.
So right through every element of the cost stack. So we see the cost of making power has changed, the cost of transporting it's changed, the cost even for retailers to bill you has changed.
Apologies. I just don't know how I keep making the same mistake over and over again. How do I get out of this loop?
The need for around 10,000 kilometres of transmission to be built, and that is to connect those new sources of generation.
Remember the scene from Fawlty Towers, Basil's upstairs and everyone walks away and he thinks he's on his own, and he squats down and he pulls his jacket up over his head and he starts jumping up and down in just ultimate frustration, and then people walk up the stairs and obviously see him. Yes, this is pretty much what I think most electricity bill payers should be feeling after you hear all this stuff. More of the same. A short recap of our Prime Minister and Energy Minister. Leading up to the election, and some of this slightly before, some of it slightly after. Check it out.
What is the total cost of the government's energy plan? Is there a straight answer to that question?
$121 billion is the cost of non-customer-owned generation, transmission and storage, as is outlined in great detail in the last version of the Integrated Systems Plan.
If renewable energy is the cheapest form of power, why are taxpayers subsidising it in the multiples of billions of dollars?
Well, the truth is that...
I don't like that. So far, off to a bad start.
We think the future is renewables, backed by gas, backed by hydro, backed by batteries.
Can you please tell the Australian people the total system cost of your plan to get the national electricity market to net zero by 2050?
AEMO says the most accurate way, the best way of describing the least cost pathway to net zero, and particularly our electricity system, is that $122 billion net present value.
The ISP is not a tool to evaluate government policy.
Sure.
It's a tool to say what needs to be delivered in order for that government policy to succeed.
Backed by the experts at the CSIRO and our energy operators and regulators, with an appropriate mix of more renewable energy, backed by storage, backed by gas peaking and firming, backed by household batteries, transmission, and a stable system.
The ISP is not a tool to evaluate government policy.
Well, clearly you're going to see, you've seen Australian Energy Market Corporation Commission reports showing 13% reduction over 10 years. If we keep going with the current plan.
The ISP is not a tool to evaluate government policy.
Here is a small example of the reports that the government bases our expert plan on, whether it is by the AEMO, the Australian Energy Regulator, the Australian Energy Market Corporation, full analysis of the pathway that the government has set out, because we base our plan on the experts.
The ISP is not a tool to evaluate government policy. Sure. It's a tool to say what needs to be delivered in order for that government policy to succeed.
This next section of the podcast is me taking the liberty to spend 20 minutes explaining to you guys my theory on why renewables cannot reduce retail electricity prices. If you don't want to listen to this and go straight through to the GOAT, I recommend you go to a timestamp of 48 minutes and 48 seconds. That will get you to the start of the GOAT segment. We are often told that renewables reduce prices while our bills keep going up. But asking questions about this disparity between the narrative and the reality is likely to get you labelled a climate denier. Well, welcome aboard if you've gotten this far. It seems to me that by now we should have a detailed explanation of exactly how renewables are supposed to reduce consumer prices. And we should all be convinced by the stunning simplicity, the elegance, or at least a crude demonstration of renewables lowering electricity prices. An example from anywhere in the world would be fine. While we are waiting for the media and perhaps, you know, a brave politician to ask this question on behalf of consumers, I present my reasoning why renewables will not ever reduce wholesale prices. And I'm using South Australian data because it has the highest penetration of wind and solar in the world. This should be exactly the experiment necessary to prove the theory, which is that more renewables means lower prices. So I've got some charts here in my write-up, and I know audio only podcast, you can't see it. Maybe one day I'll get to some video, which would be great. Someone would appreciate it. Anyway, voice for not much, and a face for not much either. So we're stuck with the audio for a while. Anyway, if you look at a chart that compares wholesale prices and renewable output, there is no correlation. Renewable output keeps going up, of course. Seasonal variations, etc. But we keep building more and we get more capacity. Does this impact the long-term average wholesale price? It does not. Does it impact the futures? It does not. The only thing we can see is an ever-increasing trend in the long-term data. Now, there is a clear correlation observable between gas price and wholesale electricity price, which is independent of how much gas is actually used to generate the electricity. Everybody who's looked knows the wholesale spot price is set every 5 minutes by the highest cost generator required to balance supply and demand. This spot price also informs a contract market through the futures price. Let's dissect the mechanisms for how renewables are supposed to reduce wholesale prices. The merit order effect. The theory goes that renewables displace more expensive generators, and so the merit order effect means cheaper wind and solar fills the bid stack, meaning a lower cost generator sets the price more often. Sure, on the face of it, that sounds logical. The missing piece is that more renewable capacity doesn't mean more generation output. More accurately, it means more generation a few times and not much generation a lot of the time. So what happens in practice as we get more wind and solar forced into the system? What I have in front of me is a very interesting chart from Paul McArdle's whatclarity.com.au. What as in W-A-T-T. Very clever, Paul. Thank you. What I see here is a chart that has a red band, a green band, and a blue band. Blue is at the bottom, representing negative wholesale price bids from generators. Green represents the $0 to $300 band, and red, various shades of red, sit on top as anything higher than $300, you know, up to the market cap. What we can see is the outside, the extremes, the very lows and the very highs are increasing in quantity, whereas the middle, the greens, the baseload generation range is shrinking. And when you zoom in and look at the $0 to $50 mark, that's almost become non-existent. So remembering that these are bids, not settled prices. So this chart is really interesting, and I'm going to be doing some work on this to try and replicate it myself and perhaps get it to a wider audience maybe. Who knows? So recall the theory that low-cost wind and solar displaces higher-cost generators. Dialing in on South Australia, and when you go to the data, which is maybe it used to be called opennem.org.au, now it's called Open Electricity, possibly the most helpful thing Mr. Holmes at Court's ever done. You can see the visualization. You can choose which state you want. You can choose time ranges. You can choose which fuel source, etc., is making electricity, and it's all basically real-time data. Now, dialing in on South Australia and filtering to look at just gas-fired peaking generators, the OCGTs, the open cycle gas turbines, we can observe that these open cycle gas turbines are operating more often and at greater output as the state adds more renewables to the system. Now, when you look at South Australia, total gas consumption, total gas-fired electricity has reduced overall, but South Australia is a bit weird. They've got these old boilers, which are gas-fired boilers, running a steam turbine. So kind of like baseload gas. Not an attractive look if you're trying to save money with high gas prices, but retiring those and with more renewables, the peakers are actually operating a lot more. Moving on from the merit order effect, I'll scroll down in my write-up, we get to price setters. As discussed, the wholesale electricity price is set every 5 minutes by the most expensive generator. The Australian Energy Regulator, the AER, and the Wholesale Market Data Series includes a representation of price setters in each region. The price in each region can actually be set by generators outside the state. And anyone who's interested, GMIT 3, operated by Snowy Hydro, the federal government, who bought the Snowy scheme back off New South Wales and Victoria for around about $7 billion prior to starting Snowy 2. Yes, recall the extra billions up front before they even started the project. So Tumut 3 is the biggest pumped hydro scheme in the national electricity market. And when it comes to periods of peak high prices in every state, Tumut 3 is often the one. If you look at these price setter charts, you may note the very low historical prices set by black and brown coal-fired generators and the relatively high prices set by batteries. The charts show that wind and solar are increasingly the price setters, and intuitively, it suggests that these negative prices should reduce the overall wholesale price. Unfortunately, the percent of time y-axis, the vertical side, does not reflect the volume of generation or when the price setting occurs. Another data set from the regulator provides a clearer picture of what generators affect the wholesale price. By allowing for how much each generator contributes to the overall supply in volume-weighted average calculation, this other chart provides several indicators of the impacts from various priced generators. So, as referenced earlier in the What Clarity Paul McArdle's chart, the $0 to $50 prices in South Australia have all but disappeared and have been replaced with $100 to $200 prices. And these are not bids, these are actually cleared values. So, and over time, a significant growth of renewable capacity does not increase the effect of very low prices. They don't change at all. It doesn't affect the total. So the whole merit order effect, the price setters, if you look at it from outside, if you zoom out a bit and you look at what's going on in the country, we're not closing, We're not closing down very low price stuff, wind and solar. And we're not closing down the very, very high price stuff, hydro, gas and batteries. We're building more of all of that stuff. We're getting rid of the stuff that sits right in the middle, in the $0 to $100 range, the coal. So it doesn't take a genius to work out what that's going to do to the prices. My next segment is called market share. So reducing market share is another death knell for the merit order effect theory. Remember, the merit order effect theory says that low-cost wind and solar displace higher-cost generators to reduce the overall price. So when very low-cost wind and solar are competing for the same market share in the day, that market share is already at a minimum due to the rooftop solar output. There's just not much load out there left after rooftop solar is taken up a lot of the space in the grid. During the day, there is a much smaller demand on the grid because of all the rooftop solar. So despite this period being mostly supplied by very low-cost wind and solar, most of the electricity generation occurs during the afternoons and overnight, when there's much less renewables generating. Another way to visualize this disparity in effect is by considering an analogy, such as a glass of water and cordial. Okay, bear with me. Some might prefer a beer analogy, but I've gone with cordial. The daytime period is a small glass, representing the reduced demand on the grid, and you only drink green cordial during the day. But you need a larger glass during the night, and you only drink red cordial at night. So even if you only drink one green glass in the day and one red glass at night, the green cordial has less overall effect on you. Over time, you consume a lot more red, and the effect of the green is negligible. This is a pretty crude way of explaining that the market share problem actually creates higher prices. It has to. Wind and solar have little impact on the overall prices because they have a smaller market. And there's some formulas you can look at there as well. My next segment is called volatility. Increasing the amount of electricity supplied by wind and solar increases the volatility of both the supply, the megawatts, and the price, the dollars. And I've got some charts here. You might have seen them on my LinkedIn feed or Twitter feed. And I've gone price setters by fuel type in South Australia. And I've done the year 2010 and the year 2024. And, you know, if, again, if I could show you the chart, it'd be great. Anyway, go online and check it out. So the effects of high volatility spread throughout the system, affecting generators and retailers. One example is when a cloud floats across a solar farm, obscuring the sun and creating a gap in supply. A separate source of electricity must always be on standby to fill this gap. That standby generator is paid even if it doesn't run, and when it runs, it is expensive. These costs further erode the marginal cost benefits of wind and solar. Another example is due to wind fluctuations. AEMO had a very interesting forecasting webinar in 2019, which I was fortunate enough to have dialed into and downloaded the slides. I'm not even sure if these slides are available anymore. As a side note, they were prepared by a fellow called Jack Fox, who also produces the NEM data visualization, which is quite a good one if you want to download that on your phone. So as AEMO puts the wind fluctuations, and I quote, "A very rapid, within a 5-minute interval, unforecast wind speed change can increase the difficulty of managing system frequency on the power system, as the power generation from a wind farm rapidly increases or decreases unexpectedly." A rapid, e.g. within a 2-hour interval, unforecast wind speed change can increase the difficulty of managing the supply-demand balance due to the need to ensure there is sufficient other generation online to smooth out the wind generation variability, unquote. This is basic stuff. Now, separate to the higher wholesale costs incurred due to intermittent and variable wind and solar, this is in the physical side, volatility also increases costs for electricity retailers, who mostly buy electricity in advance through cap and swap contracts. Now, I've got an image which talks about hedging strategies, and I've superimposed volatile supply from wind and solar over the top, and you can see that, you know, again, if we had the visuals, you'd be able to see that. But clearly, lower volatility allows a more competitive hedging strategy because the hedged volumes can be lower. Less demand for peak caps means the insurance is priced lower. There's less demand for it. Therefore, you don't need as much of it. Therefore, people are trying to get a better deal. So those lower costs for retailers push into lower prices for consumers. Conversely, greater volatility means greater risk and therefore higher prices for consumers, increased demand on the insurance. The insurance is buying more guaranteed price electricity in the future, even if you don't need it. So there's plenty more to discuss about the relationships between generators and retailers, including the market share dominance of the large retailers with their own generators. Now, the rest of the system. So far, we've only talked about basically the wholesale part. So separately to the points made about wholesale price, the electricity supply chain includes networks, retail, and environmental costs. The cost stack, or the bill stack, is often used to describe the total system cost of the electricity system. Current plans to expand the transmission network. Earlier in the podcast, we heard from Daniel Westerman, of head of AEMO, whose plan is the integrated system plan, which doesn't evaluate government costs, but does kickstart 10,000 kilometres of transmission projects. So that's going to cost around $30 billion minimum, a cost not only incurred to force more renewables into the system, transmission costs are transferred directly to our electricity bills. More transmission means higher bills. Right, so far, we've discussed the primary factors affecting the wholesale electricity price: merit order effect, market share, price setters, volatility. We've investigated the effects of wind and solar on these components in South Australia and found no credible pathway for intermittent generation to lower the wholesale price. If more wind and solar isn't lowering prices in South Australia, how will more wind and solar lower prices in the rest of the country? The current plan is to supply much of the grid demand from home batteries in the low voltage distribution network. If this is to occur, there will be large costs added to the network in order to cope with the extra demand, not to mention the cost of the batteries themselves. The distribution networks are designed to transfer electricity from the grid down to the consumers. Converting legacy networks to safely and reliably manage large two-way electricity flows will add enormous costs to an already expensive $80 billion asset. And this is in parallel with massively expanding the transmission grid and generation capacity. We've discussed the increased costs of a volatile wholesale market on retailers' hedging strategies, but other costs on retailers include rooftop solar feed-in tariffs and compliance with green schemes. For details on the costs of this, we can, you know, check out AGL's annual reports, who say that the combined costs of green compliance and consumer solar are $115 a megawatt hour. That was in 2024, which converts to 11.5 cents per kilowatt hour, roughly a quarter of the average retail bill here in Queensland. So, in summary, where is the argument to support renewables lowering wholesale prices? If I missed anything, I'll be pleased to know. To summarise, I like to ask this question: which part of the bill do renewables reduce, and which part of the bill do renewables increase? People may then ask why an alternative such as coal or nuclear would be cheaper. Well, in its most basic format, the argument that a system dominated by centralised baseload generators goes like this: no new transmission, no additional transmission costs. Reduced volatility means less backup and lower risk hedging, lower retail overheads. Wholesale prices are often set closer to the $50 a megawatt hour, lower wholesale prices on average. So a more nuanced question might go like this: if gas is primarily responsible for setting the price, how does baseload generation prevent that? Well, the answer to this is that baseload coal and nuclear can actually change load to react to the grid conditions. While they're not as fast as hydro, gas, and batteries, baseload units operating as a fleet have a combined ramp rate that's totally fine for controlling the grid. Here's an example. A single large coal-fired generator, say 600 megawatts, might have a ramp rate of 6 megawatts per minute. Two of these units have a combined ramp rate of 12 megawatts per minute. A fleet of 20 has a combined ramp rate of 120 megawatts per minute. This fleet-wide operation, paired with spinning reserve and inertia, ensures grid stability for all but the most extreme scenarios, relegating gas and hydro and peakers to emergency conditions and relatively predictable widespread hot and cold periods. As it stands, the system requires gas, hydro, and batteries to respond to unpredictable clouds and breezes with widely dispersed effects. That reduced demand on expensive standby generation translates into a predictable, stable operation and lower costs for consumers. There is a caveat, though. With the huge amount of renewables in the system today, every baseload generator has to survive the lost market share. A generator's income, in its most basic form, is dependent on two things: the price it sells electricity for and how much it sells. If the price is high, it doesn't need to sell as much. Conversely, if it sells a lot, it doesn't need to sell it for much. It gets the same income. Now, because a baseload generator's costs are largely fixed, you've got wages, insurance, maintenance, it needs to sell at a higher price to make up for the lost market share. Hence, I don't believe a private company will ever build a baseload generator in the current system, and it can only be a government decision leveraging long-term finance, and even then, only if a government decides to revert to a baseload-dominated system. In the meantime, we have an increasingly intermittent base system with no hope of lower prices. That's a... Shit, that's a 20-minute rant. All right, time for the goat.
The fucking goat outside.
It's just a goat.
No, it's a fucking goat.
Chris Bowen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me on, David.
So is the target of reducing emissions by 43% by 2030 now looking more difficult to achieve?
Well, it's never been easy, but we are by and large on track. And, you know, last year I released all the forecasts. But in relation to the figures you just mentioned, I describe them as mixed. We had a couple of releases of figures this week. Renewable energy for the first quarter, very strong, very encouraging, very pleasing.
Well, base loaders, we have Chris Bowen on the couch with the goat again. This time it's the Insiders with David Spears from June 1st, 2025. And if renewables is very pleasing to Mr. Bowen, you know, maybe he could spare a thought for us people who actually pay our own electricity bills. Anyway, on with the goat.
But those emissions figures that you referred to for 2024, obviously there are some areas that are encouraging, like industrial emissions way down and lower than 2021, for example.
I have here a handy document from the dccceew.gov.au website called National Greenhouse Gas Inventory Quarterly Update, December 2024. Now, I go to page 10, which talks about emissions reduction. Of course, all things talking about emissions reduction, but, you know, who cares? Emissions from the agricultural sector decreased 2.0%, mainly due to the decrease in crop production. I guess we can blame climate change for that one. Electricity sector emissions increased 1.5% over the year to December 2024 due to unusual combinations of weather and demand dynamics over the March, June, and September quarters. Okay. Industrial processes and product use emissions decreased 5% over the year to December 2024, driven by lower production of steel. That sounds positive. Transport emissions increased 1.9% over the year, mainly driven by diesel consumption for road transport and domestic aviation activity, both reaching their highest level on record.
Transport continues to be a challenge. And I guess I'd say, David, that it's a reminder that when we do take action, it can work, like industry.
I guess now we're talking about the safeguard mechanism and forcing industrial users to reduce emissions by fines.
Traditionally, a lot of Australia's emissions reductions come from the land sector, and as La Nina's coming to an end, that has reduced. And it's a reminder that we need to do more. So take transport, for example. Now, our new vehicle efficiency standards only came into force on the 1st of January, for example. I wouldn't pretend they've yet had an impact.
The new vehicle efficiency scheme is a carbon tax on car manufacturers. There's no way of getting out of that.
It was a controversial issue at the election with a choice for the Australian people where we said we'll keep going, the Liberals said they'd stop. So these are the sorts of things that we need to keep going on to ensure that we can achieve and will achieve a 43% emissions reduction, which I'm very confident we can and will.
It bothers me somewhat that this fantasy, this pantomime continues basically unchallenged. I mean, Spearsy seems like, you know, if he's upsetting both sides, he's probably doing the right job. But goodness me, I mean, I'm looking at a chart here from the greenhouse gas emissions, you know, quarterly update, and it's basically flat lines. Despite every policy from every state government and federal government forcing emissions reduction, you know, costs into the system.
And part of that, of course, is having 82% renewables by 2030. A lot of people in industry say one of the problems they're facing in rolling out renewables is the approvals process, the environmental approvals to get big wind farms, solar farms up. Is that something that you'll fix?
Well, firstly, let me say again, we're making good progress there. 15 gigawatts added since we came to office. That's three snowy hydro schemes added in capacity since we came to office. So there's a lot happening.
Okay, there might be a lot happening, but, you know, capacity of wind and solar is not genuine capacity. If it's not available during peak demand, what's the point of it? If I was to ask for a second opinion on that statement, as in what's the point of wind and solar if it's not there during peak demand, well, I could call on US Energy Secretary Chris Wright.
If you're not there at peak demand, you're just a parasite on the grid because you just make the other sources turn up and down as you come and go.
On planning approvals, yeah, we are continuing to work on that. I guess to say a couple of things. We've put more money into the environment side of my portfolio to get faster approvals or rejections, faster yes or no, as is appropriate. We're also working with the states. Only about 20% of renewable applications come to the federal minister for approval.
I find that statement very interesting, and it makes me think, why so much? Why does even 20% have to go to the federal minister? If a bloody electricity generator is connecting to the local grid in a state, what the hell's it got to do with the bloody federal minister? I honestly think this is one of the big problems. This is the centralized decision-making process means the state ministers get to abrogate their own responsibilities and they go, oh, it's AMO's decision. Oh, someone else did it. Oh, Chris Bowen did it. No thanks. Put it back on the state ministers. Make them do their job.
We're working with the states and we have renewable energy transformation agreements with every state except for Queensland. Hallelujah. And part of that is ensuring that the planning system is fit for purpose at the state level.
Maybe we should just leave it all to the states. Hey, Chris?
And I'm working very closely with my state energy minister colleagues to ensure that's the case, and they're making good progress as well.
Okay, so you will hit the 2030 target in your view?
Well, on both targets, if you look at 82%, again, very encouraging figures in the last quarter. We're now at 46% renewables in the last quarter last year and 43% in the first quarter this year. It moves from quarter to quarter. And again, 15 gigawatts. That's three snowy hydros added since we came to office and a big pipeline of investment coming through. So, yes, the 82% target does have challenges. I've never suggested that it's a linear line and it all happens easily or it's all automatic. But with the right policy settings, which we do have, and the right approach from government, yes, we can continue to be on track, facing headwinds and challenges from time to time, of course. But we're seeing very strong investment figures.
This is a perfect example of Chris Bowen exhibiting cricket behaviour. Yes, no, wait. Yes, of course we can do it. Oh, but there are challenges.
I want to ask you about the next target, which will be the 2035 climate target that you need to set in the coming months. When will you announce that and how ambitious should we expect you to be?
Well, let's deal with the ambition first. It'll be ambitious and achievable. It's got to be both those things. And
ambitious and achievable. Okay. What about affordable? What about the impacts on people of assigning these arbitrary targets and, you know, forcing the planning process to adopt them and therefore implement, and which is code for spend a shit ton of money trying to get there for no apparent reason?
David, in Australia, we have, if I say so myself, I think world's best practice for setting the climate target. It's based on our Climate Change Act. Together with the United Kingdom, we have a very what's well regarded around the world as the best process with independent advice, which comes to me, and then I take to the cabinet and we work through, and that advice, if the government hasn't followed it, is released and it's transparent all to see. Released either way, whether we follow it or not. That's really good process. Now, the UNFCCC has asked countries to set their targets by September. Of course, that's what we'll do, but we won't do it today before we're ready, not before I've received the advice from the Climate Change Authority, which they're still working on. Then I'll consider it, take it through Cabinet, and it'll be transparent for all to see.
In that almost one-minute segment, Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen has said that he's going to set new emissions reduction targets for Australia. And these are going to be based on numbers given to him by the Climate Change Authority. Who runs the Climate Change Authority? Who's in charge there?
Today, Cabinet has agreed to appoint the Honourable Matt Keane as Chair of the Climate Change Authority.
And what does the Climate Change Authority do, you know, apart from emissions reduction targets? What else does Albo say they do?
Climate Change Authority is an independent statutory body that provides advice to government on how we can provide the cheapest and cleanest power to Australians.
You won't find Matt Keane disagreeing with Albo anytime soon.
The latest scientific, engineering and economic advice that's looked at these matters that I'm aware of is from the CSIRO and AEMO, and they very clearly say that the cheapest way to transition our electricity system is to move towards renewables backed up by firming and also storage.
The ISP is not a tool to evaluate government policy.
Matt Keynes said plenty of things about electricity and AEMO and the ISP and CSIRO, etc. Here he is during one of the energy inquiries, again, that kicked off around about November 2024. This is him on Hansard during one of those inquiries.
So AEMO, and they've looked at what the cheapest replacement cost of the existing infrastructure is. So at a high level, they've looked at the alternative solutions to providing cheap, reliable electricity, and they've said that the integrated system plan is the way to do that.
The ISP is not a tool to evaluate government policy.
Okay, so we have a good idea of Matt Keane, head of the Climate Change Authority. We have a good idea of his openness and transparency and, you know, resistance to ideology. What does Chris Bowen say about it all again?
Independent advice, which comes to me.
And the experts tell us, and I agree with them, that if we get this transition right, we can not only put downward pressure on electricity bills for families and businesses right across the country, but we can protect our environment and make our economy even stronger and more prosperous for everyone forever.
The ISP is not a tool to evaluate government policy.
One of the reasons why the Climate Change Authority and its chair, Matt Keane, has delayed the advice is because of Donald Trump. He's pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and his administration boasts about driving a dagger through the heart of climate change religion.
But by stopping the rapid increase in intermittent sources on grids, we will reduce stress on grids and reduce costs.
Okay, I'm going to skip out some fluff about emissions reduction and, you know, Chris Bowen trying to take the moral high ground, and we'll cut back in where he comes back in with trying to say that it's all a good idea.
Fundamentally, our government will always act in the Australian national interest, and that means seizing the economic opportunities which come from action on climate change, building our capacity for renewable energy. Net zero, for example, has been endorsed by the majority of the world's emitting countries, Australia included, and it remains in our economic best interest, as the Morrison government. You heard it here first. I agree with the Morrison government. As the Morrison government pointed out, it's very much in Australia's economic best interest.
I apologise for subjecting listeners to so much concentrated bullshit in one go. Potentially net zero is not a great idea at all, as observed around the world.
But just on that, if the US is walking away from net zero and if others aren't doing enough when it comes to climate change, I know you've been looking at the option of Australia imposing a carbon tariff or a carbon border adjustment mechanism, as the Europeans are looking at. What's your thinking on that at the moment?
No surprises on what Chris Bowen thinks is a good way to improve productivity and reduce costs. Carbon taxes.
Well, we've been, again, clear that we want to ensure Australian industry is best placed to compete in a decarbonising world. And Australian industry has a lot to bring to the table as the world's investors and consumers and insurers and boards require decarbonisation plans. And we've been working with industry.
I'm sorry, what? We're beholden to company boards now? In Australia, we impose taxes on our industries, on our farmers, on our consumers to appease boards, to appease other countries? No, no thanks.
You know, big industry to ensure that's the case. Now, in relation to how we can best compete, as you know, I commissioned Professor Frank Yotso last year to advise the government.
Yeah, okay. So, Professor Frank Yotso, Australian National University, climate change, nutter, absolutely off the planet in terms of what he thinks we should be doing. Here's a taste of Professor Frank Yotso.
Why is everyone talking about net zero emissions? Well, humanity puts greenhouse gas emissions up into the atmosphere, and we need to stop doing that to stop global warming. How are we going to do it? Well, we're going to largely stop the burning of coal, oil, and gas. We're going to drastically reduce various greenhouse gas emissions from industry as well as from agriculture. That will get us most of the way to zero, but not all the way. And the remaining emissions we will compensate for by drawing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, putting it underground or using it as products. What's the key for it? Well, it's electricity supply. We need clean power, carbon-free electricity, which then can be used throughout the economy and displace the oil, gas, and coal that we're currently using directly. That is the key to net zero, a clean power supply.
It's not a tumor.
It may not be a tumor, but there's certainly something wrong going on inside those brains of people who think this way.
He's made public consultation papers. Those papers make clear he thinks the settings are right in the short term.
We're going to drastically reduce various greenhouse gas emissions from industry as well as from agriculture.
But there are things we can think about in the medium to long term.
And the remaining emissions we will compensate for by drawing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, putting it underground or using it as products.
And obviously that's something I'll continue to progress this term with my cabinet colleagues, looking at how we do that, how we can best ensure that Australian industry, as it decarbonises, can compete.
So a carbon tariff is still a prospect?
Well, I would, you know, I think I'd urge against sweeping generalisations about policy settings and, you know...
The man who warns against sweeping generalisations said this a couple of years ago in Question Time.
Mr Deputy Speaker, as difficult as our current predicament is, it's still incumbent on us to be truthful and frank about how much worse it will be if we and the world don't act now.
Somewhat reminiscent of a certain Greta Thunberg. When did she say that? When did she do her Dare You speech? 2020? Anyway, here's an extract for the feels, for the laughs.
I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
What could be the case is obviously we look at particular sectors first around cement and lime are places that we've looked at in particular. But again, I'm not going to get in front of a process. We asked Professor Yotso to look at this. He's been doing excellent work consulting Australian industry very heavily.
We're going to drastically reduce various greenhouse gas emissions from industry as well as from agriculture.
You know, I've had lots of meetings with steelmakers and cement makers about these things over the past 12 months, for example, getting their feedback. And we'll have more to say during the course of this term.
So it sounds an awful lot to me as if Mr. Bowen is going to be considering, of course, on advice from the Climate Change Authority and even from Professor Frank Yotso, that they're going to put taxes on things. That'll help. okay, there's some stuff there about Trump and tariffs and bits and pieces and whatever. We'll cut back into the conversation when we're talking about net zero.
Do you understand the coalition also now wanting to look at, revisit the 2050 net zero target?
No.
How dare you?
No, because net zero is the essential starting point. Let me make 3 points. I've already made the point about the United States being 12% of emissions. That's point one. Hmm. Point two, net zero by 2050 was set out by the IPCC as the minimum action required to avoid the catastrophic impacts of climate change.
People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing.
I mean, if you're not for net zero, you're for the catastrophic impacts of climate change.
We are in the beginning of a mass extinction.
Goodness me, the script doesn't get much closer than that, does it?
And then the third point is that this remains in Australia's economic best interest. When Scott Morrison gave Australia the policy of net zero by 2050, he pointed out it would be economically beneficial for Australia and for Australians. And he was right to do so.
Maybe that's one of the arguments that the LNP should use against net zero. Scott Morrison did it. Scott Morrison turned out to be hugely unpopular in his second term. You know, maybe tie net zero to Morrison and be done with it.
And even if it wasn't an obligation, it would remain the right economic policy for Australia. Dan Tehan used to think that when he was Trade Minister. I hope he still thinks that as Climate Change Shadow Minister.
Oh, gosh, I hope not.
But it is very fundamentally the case. I understand a political party after an election defeat reviewing policies and maybe the how, but not the why.
No, we don't dare ask why. Not if, you know, every other country is basically ignoring any emissions reduction policies.
And not the weather. What the Liberal Party is showing really here is that they are not comfortable with modern Australia and the economic challenges facing modern Australia.
In the interests of time and efficiency, I'm going to cut the conversation off there. For those who are interested in the remaining, I guess, nearly half of the interview with David Spears, Chris Bowen is quizzed about the Northwest Shelf gas extensions, the lifetime extensions over there. So there's plenty more for the goat to get into in future episodes. I recorded this interview with Matt Canavan on the afternoon of 30th of May. It was a rainy, cold winter's day. Since then, the Nats have had a party room, I don't know, whatever you call it, conference, convention, and voted against net zero. So congratulations to Matt, Barnaby, and the rest of them for entertaining some sanity and common sense, finally. Matt Canavan, welcome to the Baseload Podcast.
Great to be with you, Ben.
Well, it's a Friday afternoon and it's wet and miserable, and we've all got better things to do than talk about the bloody politics and the energy systems. Thanks for joining me. Before we get into the details, your electorate, did the voters buy into net zero where you are?
I don't think so, Ben. Up here in central Queensland, the members here that got elected are pretty openly against this mad rush to renewable energy. The people like Colin Boyce, who did an amazing job, he got a 6% swing to him. He's been campaigning regularly with a guy called Steve Nowakowski, I think you know, former Greens candidate. We're just aghast at all the destruction of the bushland around here. Same with Michelle Landry, my local member. A lot of her electorate's been ravished by this stuff. She campaigned strongly against the Burdekin Pioneer Pumped Hydro Project, which is just ludicrous. Thankfully, that's been ended. This week, we've had another massive wind factory cancelled that was going to devastate bushland just west of Rockhampton. Massive amounts of koala habitat, high-value koala habitat. And it's just really frustrating that the people doing this stuff are doing it so-called in the name of green energy, but they pay scant regard to the green forests they're destroying. And the way our landscape is, a lot of the areas that they're touching are pristine, haven't been touched. And it's sort of a strange situation for me, Ben, that I didn't get into politics to wear a koala suit, but I find myself effectively donning one to protect these little critters. Like, I don't want to see our high-value koala habitat destroyed, especially when these projects deliver basically nothing. This particular project, the Moonlight Range, that's been cancelled, was going to be 10 jobs. That's on their website. You can go on their website, they're going to give 10 jobs. You get more jobs from a local service station, and it doesn't produce much power. It takes up 20 times the size of the land of the Stanwell coal-fired power station just down the road, and just a tenth of the power. So, yeah, why are we doing this? Why would we destroy our bushland for no real benefit to Australians, and certainly no environmental benefit? You get the environmental degradation locally, and it's not going to change the temperature of the globe, obviously. A small project here in the context of the world madly rushing to more oil and gas, more coal.
Even if the best of intentions were absolutely correct and we were going to have cheaper electricity and lots of jobs and very clean sort of industry out of the renewables transition, it still wouldn't make any difference to the global temperature or the CO2, because renewables sort of bring all those emissions forwards. And they happen now, but in China, which I guess makes the Canberra and the Sydney and Melbourne people feel pretty good about it all. I remember a couple of years ago you had Bob Brown come up. Do you reckon you could get the Teals up to Rocky in a convoy like Bob Brown did?
Look, who knows? It's seemingly, unfortunately, a lot of the environmental groups go missing on these environmental issues. I know some of the committed locals are very worried about what's happening to the local environment. Some of them I've butted heads with on issues like Adani when Bob Brown came up. We were on different sides, but I know them, and you know, we're all part of the same community, and they're good people, and I understand where they're coming from. And they're very frustrated, but certainly at an organisational level, the Queensland Conservation Council just don't seem to bat an eyelid about all this stuff.
They're not into conserving much if they're into clearing the trees for the wind farms.
It's a bit odd. But give Bob Brown his due. You mentioned him. Bob's been campaigning against these massive wind factories going in around his area in Tasmania. I was actually, ironically enough, I attended a rally during the election with Steve Nowakowski, who I mentioned. This rally was at the Lotus Creek wind factory, a bit further north from Moonlight Range. And we actually Zoom called in to another rally in Tasmania that I was told Bob Brown was meant to be at. So in a way, the world's come full circle, and I'm actually rallying with Bob Brown now.
In arms.
So it's a crazy, crazy world. But someone's got to do it. And, we've got to get the message out. Look, I've also come, I mean, over my political career, I do think it's very important that I hate the word social license because people abuse the term, but I do think it's important for large-scale projects to win the support of local people because if you can't win the support of local people where you operate, I tend to find that you're not otherwise a good company. Like, a good company will find ways for their investment, their business, to benefit local people in a way that everyone has buy-in. And so in the mining sphere, like a Adani Carmichael mine, Adani's going to build has dug a big hole. And, you know, people don't necessarily want big holes in their backyard, but Adani's providing 2,000 jobs. They have a local buy program to support small businesses in the area. And so people can see that, look, okay, that's not ideal. Didn't want a big hole put there, but you know, we do see that we need business, we need jobs, our kids need a future. And that's why when the Adani mine was looking shaky, you had 800 people come out and rally against Bob Brown, local people, and a mix of people, business people, CFMEU members, farmers. It was the most eclectic protest I've ever been to. But they all rallied for it because they saw the benefits locally of it. There will be no rally in favour of the Moonlight Range wind project. There's not going to be 800 local Rockhampton people come out and say, oh, it's terrible, we've lost these 10 jobs.
That'd be the Teals.
I mean, that's a challenge.
Well, that'd be the Teals convoy, Matt. They'd have to turn there.
Yeah, but
they'd have to get their high beams on for a change.
They wouldn't even know where Moonlight Range is, right? It's just not on their radar. It's a bumper sticker politics for them. So I'm not against all renewable energy. There'll be places in the country where it makes sense. I think a lot of the solar stuff is pretty exciting in certain areas. I mean, wind is a very old technology. It's not new, obviously, but maybe somewhere. But you can't destroy the environment. And if you're going to operate in a local area, you need to win their support. So find a way, guys. You're spending billions of dollars. Find a way that local people get buy-in. And if you can't get that, well, my shareholders are the voters. I've got to look after their interests.
Yeah, indeed. So I still like the image of the Teals coming up to Rocky in a convoy, but I also actually quite like the idea of you doing a convoy through Teal territory. Any chance of Canavan's coal caravan in Sally Steggall's electorate?
I'll do that with the koala suit on so I can go incognito.
Yeah, all right. I'll stand by for that one. You're staunch in your opposition to net zero, and the rest of the world, well, the rest of the world that matters anyway, is aligning in the same way. What's going on here in Australia? Why can't we turn this around?
Well, I don't think the Australian people have been given a choice, unfortunately. And it's a pretty radical proposal. It's so radical that I don't think a lot of my colleagues, I shouldn't say a lot, but so I don't think some of my colleagues have actually fully got their head around what it means.
Does anyone know what it means?
Well, I don't know if anyone knows how we get there. I mean, in concept, you know what it means. What it means is we've got to fundamentally change how we make almost everything, including grow our food and transport that food and other goods. We've got to revolutionise everything within a generation. Because you still get this misnomer from some of my colleagues that, oh, look, we can get to net zero by just doing nuclear. And, you know, I think we waved our hands a bit on this in the last few years, and I'm a big supporter of nuclear. I've got my own bill before the parliament to remove this ridiculous nuclear ban. But electricity is only a third of our carbon emissions. And so even if you did run the whole electricity system on nuclear and renewables,
what do you do?
How do you make fertilizer? How do you make plastics?
Steel,
cement, methane, these ridiculous methane emissions from cattle. All those issues remain, and there's no solution for them. There's no proper plan about doing this. And it's just absolutely insane for any organization, let alone a country, to pursue such a radical plan without knowing how to do it. And it's not just some idea. We have in law now targets on 219 of our largest companies.
Yep.
This is called the so-called safeguard mechanism. So most of our mines, most of our factories, some transport companies have these obligations imposed on them by law that they have to get to net zero over a 25-year time frame. So every year, roughly speaking, they reduce their emissions by just under 5%. And that's in law, and it's a ratcheting effect. So for the first few years of the scheme, hasn't completely bit for most, although there are some exceptions to this rule, but most haven't been able to wear it. But talking to a lot of these businesses, if this continues over a 10-year period and they're looking at upwards of almost half their emissions having to be offset, they just can't afford it. They just can't survive, and there's certainly not investment going into these sectors. We're missing out on that when we should have, with the resources we have, we should be an industrial powerhouse, and we're far from that right now.
I'm seeing some journalists in various places and commentators start to talk a little bit about that, but still, I think it was the Morrison government came out with a net zero roadmap a few years ago, but I haven't seen anything from the Albo government. Is there such a roadmap? Do they know what the pathway looks like for net zero?
Look, I suppose the last time they did something was the document they put out before the 2022 election. I think it was Powering Australia's Future or something like that. I can't remember one of these boilerplate titles. And that is part of it, this safeguard mechanism I mentioned to you. However, that was only a component of it, right? Because that doesn't actually cover the electricity sector. It only covers some of our industrial sector, the companies that emit over 100,000 tonnes a year, carbon emissions, 100,000 tonnes of carbon emissions a year. And then they've got a rough plan for electricity with the 82% renewable target, et cetera, which they're not going to meet, but it's a plan, so to speak. But it's not. It's what keep in mind that this plan they put forward, it was all predicated on economic modelling that they've completely junked. So this was the modelling that that in their view showed a $275 cut in carbon emissions. Keep in mind, sorry, in power prices. Keep in mind that wasn't just that impact in the modelling wasn't just to give households cost of living relief. Indeed, at the time, cost of living wasn't as big a political issue as it's become. They also claim, with less publicity now, looking back on it, they claim that this lower power price, which would be for everyone, not just to households, businesses, and it's very important to stress that businesses in Australia use four times the amount of power that households do. Mm-hmm. So that lower power price for all was going to create 300,000 jobs. You know, they said that this net zero plan would create 300,000 jobs, including in hydrogen and all these other things. I mean, where are they? And where there's not been a lot of accountability to the government about that. Now, partly that's because employment's holding up. You know, we're not having high unemployment rate, but wages aren't holding up. Wages are going backwards at a rapid rate, real wages, and have done the last few years since we adopted net zero. That's caused everyone to suffer. There haven't been these massive job opportunities of high-paying hydrogen jobs with high productivity and with high returns to give people a boost in their standard of living. The net zero plan has only led people to become poorer in this country.
Surely at some point, with the rest of the world turning against net zero, I mean, Trump's obviously out, India was never in, Russia was never in, the UK tried, but you know, even Tony Blair said the other day that it's a bad idea. Germany, the right wing sort of parties who are anti want to quell the immigration and put nuclear back online are they're all rising in the polls whenever they have an election. At some point something's got to give, right? What is that tipping point, do you think?
Well, we're at a step. We're as a centre right party. Now, and I don't think this penny has dropped for a lot of my colleagues. I've spoken to lots of them the last couple of weeks, but perhaps they don't keep up with international news as much as I do. But yeah, we are really, really out of step now across the Western world, especially the English-speaking world, on net zero. The UK Conservatives have dropped support for net zero, did so a few months ago. As you mentioned, I mean, the Republicans, and that's not just Donald Trump. As an obsession with Donald Trump, obviously, but the Republicans have never, as a group, there's not any prominent Republican that has ever signed up to net zero emissions. So that's a non-starter. Canada's walked away. Both, in fact, the left-wing government of Canada has scrapped carbon taxes left, right, and centre under pressure. And yes, as you mentioned over the weekend, New Zealand has also dropped support for net zero. We're the only English-speaking country in the world where the centre-right political party remains committed to this left-wing utopian fantasy, and I would say that, well, surely then the onus of proof, if you like, is on some of my colleagues who want to keep support for net zero. Like, why do you want to do this when you're so out of whack with every other political force in the world that's trying to put together a similar coalition? Look, and that's putting the politics of it. I don't like talking about the politics too much because I really just want to make a decision that's best for our country, Ben. Like, I get really frustrated with these arguments that somehow we've got to adopt this radical, nonsensical plan that potentially costs Australians their jobs just to protect the very small number of jobs of politicians. Like, that's not a fair argument. That is not why we're there. That's not why I spend half of the year away from my family. I do want to actually fight for things that I genuinely believe will make this country a better place. And it's up to me then. The trick in politics is to find a way to communicate why you think those things are in the interest of the country, even when at one stage they might be unpopular or you might need to do some work to get people to your side. I just find we're playing, the last few years, we've put politics around the other way, where we've asked people, well, what do you want us to believe first? And then we go and fight for that. Because we don't passionately believe in it, and we've come to it in a very mechanical management consulting sort of way, we're not very good at convincing people of our arguments because there's not this authenticity there. There's not a genuine belief, and we lose. And when you look at the last decade or so of elections, it's been the times where we have actually fought against the radical climate activism that we've done very well. As Tony Abbott said, when we make climate an economic issue, we win. When we make it an environmental issue, we lose. And that's a simple analysis, but it does check out when we fought Bob Brown and the Adani and had that rally in Claremont and Scott Morrison proudly held coal in the parliament. We won. We won in 2019, very unexpectedly, from behind.
Indeed.
Tony Abbott won in 2010 and 2013, opposing carbon taxes. And then when we've gone soft on the issue under Malcolm Turnbull in 2016, to Scott Morrison, and now this time, of course, when we've been signed up to net zero, it's been an absolute electoral catastrophe.
Yeah, I have to. That's all solid evidence, and no one can really push back against that. That's just exactly what's happened. And I'm more skeptical than most, and getting more cynical as I get older. So I've been saying to some people around me, I said, this is not Chris Bowen's second term as energy minister. It's more like his eighth. Because we've had those policies since Kevin 07. We've had a few improvements along the way, but we haven't been able to roll any of it back significantly. And I think that's part of that is,
well, we did. I mean, Tony Abbott did scrap the carbon tax, and that was the last time you saw saw a reduction in power prices. It did reduce power prices after that. But yes, look, it then fizzled out once Malcolm Turnbull took over, and we sort of continued down this path of shutting down reliable power stations and opening unreliable ones. And that, I mean, it sort of shocks me that this is in any way astounding or shocking result, that if you shut down your reliable power and open up unreliable, unpredictable power sources, you get less secure grids with higher average costs and ultimately higher prices. It's happened everywhere in the world. We're not different.
We're not closing down the expensive gas and hydro, and then we're adding expensive batteries. We're not closing down the very, very volatile wind and solar, but we're closing down the stable, boring, predictable sort of middle price, the $50 a megawatt hour stuff. We're just chucking it out, which is madness to me.
Well, I just had a look. You mentioned it's a bit wet and cloudy and miserable here in Queensland, certainly where I am. And I had a look, and I've just updated it now. So, well, it's now up to 83%. 93. Yeah, I didn't add it. No, with gas. Didn't add in the open cycle there as well. Once you add in both forms of gas, 93% fossil fuels right now.
Well, of course it is, yeah, because when you want electricity, you're not going to adjust your lifestyle to do without it. One of the risks that we're going into, obviously, is that as we start closing down, well, we've been closing down the coal units for a few years, every next remaining coal unit that gets closed has a greater and greater impact, until the point of time when there will be in unkind terms, a coal clunker trips at the worst possible time and we get blackouts. And of course, the media and all the activists are going to go, see, I told you so. Coal's the problem. Turn it all off. And it's just, I don't know, the narrative just, it gives me emotional damage sometimes, to be honest. It hurts me.
Well, I hope we don't end up in that situation. That's what I worry about too, that somehow we may not learn until we take some lessons in the school of hard knocks. And I don't want to see that happen, because we'll end up in the Spanish situation where they may not get their aluminium industry back. You know, they've just had this catastrophic blackout that lasted, I think, 7 or 8 hours or so. An aluminium smelter can only really go without power for about 3 hours without the potlines melting freezing over, and then you're done and you got to rebuild the whole thing. So Spain already had lost its, I think, two other aluminium smelters. It was down to one thanks to high power prices, and it may never get an industry back. And that's a huge industry for Australia, very important for me here in central Queensland. The town of Gladstone would in effect not really, certainly not exist in its current form if the aluminium smelter would have shut. You've got a situation now where the owner of that smelter, Rio Tinto, has its hand out, and it's getting massive subsidies, or going to get massive subsidies, apparently, from the Queensland government just to stay open, because they're trying to switch to green power, which we were told was really cheap. But then I don't quite understand how, if that power is cheap or cheaper than coal, how come they need a subsidy that's been reported to be potentially up to $300-400 million a year, a year, for one, for Rio Tinto, one of the biggest companies in the world, getting $300-400 million a year of taxpayer dollars to stay open. How come they need that when they switched to green power, but they didn't need it when they had the apparently more expensive coal power? Something doesn't add up there. Keep in mind, Ben, that when we shut down the car industry, that was costing us about $400 million a year for the whole car industry across the whole country. And that subsidy was seen to be economically not sustainable. And we're now going to a situation where possibly just one aluminium smelter needs almost the same amount of money to stay alive because of this green power madness.
Well, don't worry, Matt. The steel industry is going to soak up a bunch of subsidies. Pretty soon we'll be paying the coal plants to stay available, even if they're not running. What else can we subsidize? The plastic side. We don't make glass anymore. Do we even make plastic in Australia? I don't know if we do.
Raw materials, no. So we have to import plastic nodules to make things. So we can't make now poly pipe from scratch. That's the widely used material in farming often to run water across farms. We can't make that from scratch here. Can't make a water tank, a plastic water tank at least, that often used in farms. Can't make them. We don't make urea anymore. Urea is the most important fertilizer in farming. That's all gets imported from China and the Middle East. Both those products, both the plastics and the urea, are made from natural gas. But because of ridiculous restrictions, we did have plenty of it. And we did have an issue with the Bass Strait declining. That was our source of really affordable gas. But we've done nothing as a country to try and replace that field. With the exception of the Queensland coal seam gas fields, but they're not the same productivity. And we've locked up gas production in Victoria and New South Wales, parts of Queensland. And we've got gas shortages. And that has meant the closure of these essential industries. And for the first time since the early settlers, Australia really can't feed itself. We could not feed ourselves without the importation of urea. And we rely on China and the Middle East to do that now.
We're also going to ban live exports, so that'll put a crimp in the food industry. I don't know. What else can we ban that's going to get us on the net zero targets? Maybe someone should come up with a list and say who's next. Who's next on the chopping block?
This is the crazy thing that, we're not probably going to get rid of some of these other industries because they're just too important, like steel and aluminium. That will just be subsidised. I mean, the steel plant in Adelaide now, Whyalla, South Australia, you're looking at a $2 billion bailout, as reported before the election, to keep that alive. If we don't keep that plant alive, we won't be able to make structural steel, so the steel that makes buildings and rail lines.
Yeah, I-beams and stuff,
Won't be able to make any of that sort of material. Might be able to build a building in this country without the importation of steel from somewhere else.
There's a real security issue around this, and we are the biggest
national security issue, and we're the biggest exporter of coking coal and iron ore in the world, the two commodities that make steel.
We struggle to make steel,
and we're having to subsidize steel production.
There's some obvious parallels there. So we export a lot of meat, but our meat's quite expensive. We export a lot of gas, but our gas is expensive. We export a lot of coking coal, but our steel's expensive. We've talked about bad ideas. What are some good ideas? Have you come across any in your travels in the last couple of years?
I mean, using our natural resources again would be a huge start. So I remain hopeful that we will get to a land of common sense at some point. The good news is that there's still the majority of our coal-fired power fleet open and running. As I just described, 90% of the power coming from, and 70% of that, 70% of Queensland's power right now is coming from coal. I would hope that one area that the Liberal and National parties will look at again is seeking to provide support for reliable power stations to run first ahead of renewables, including coal. So when we were in government, we did say that we would look to establish a new generation scheme, which included coal. The new government's got a rebranded version of that called the Capacity Investment Scheme, but they're only allowing renewables to bid for that. We've said in opposition last time that we'd expand that to include gas, and that's better, but as we've just described, we don't have cheap gas anymore, unfortunately. That's why our gas plan, if you had looked at the detail, Peter Dutton's gas plan would have reduced power bills by 3%. That was our modelling, by the way, 3%. So yeah, I love the gas industry. We need to develop new gas, but the idea that's going to be a short-term, provide short-term relief to power prices is just not true. The only way we can produce a significant reduction in power bills quickly is with the expanded use of coal. It's we've got it in abundance. We've got a very good, clean coal. Our coal-fired power stations could run more, and that would lower their average cost, lower electricity prices. And I, you know, radically argue, Ben, I know it's a crazy idea, but when China's building two coal-fired power stations a week, I reckon maybe we just build three or four here. That'll probably get us through, make a big difference. And I don't know how, I don't understand the science. I'm not a scientist, but it seems strange to me that China can build 50 of these, or sorry, 100 of these a year. But if we build three or four, that blows the planet up. Not the other ones. The 100 in China are fine and not worthy of criticism. In fact, we export the coal to them to help them run. But a few just here in Australia were a big issue. So I don't get that. I don't understand that. But I think there are some ideas, at least in the energy space, which could bring short-term relief. And look, long-term, I do want to build nuclear. I do want to try and find new oil and gas fields. That'd be great. But those things take time, of course.
Yeah, indeed. Now, I think you're right. The key is, and I think I was listening to an interview with Leif Van Onselen today, and he's like, he's outlining similar things to what you're saying, that we have all the stuff, but we just don't use the stuff. Everyone else is allowed to use the stuff, but we can't. It's a very disconcerting situation. Now, Matt, last time we talked, which was, it was a little while ago now, I was not complimentary of the energy bureaucracies, but you were a little more favorable. I actually don't think the leadership of these organizations are serving the public interest very well. You've seen them all in action for another couple of years now, and you went through the inquiries around Christmas time. If you had the opportunity, would you shake it up a little bit?
Yes, you must have got me in a good mood that day, because I'm pretty sure I've called them all for all of them to be sacked. they've failed as organisations. Like, I'm not trying to pass judgment at a personal level on any of them. I'm sure they're nice people, but they're very important. They're in very important roles, and
their ideas are terrible.
The fruits are terrible. Like, you judge a tree by its fruit, right? And the fruits of our energy organisations have been a disaster for our country. They've been telling us that the cheapest form of power is renewable energy. They've said it ad nauseum. They've allowed a situation to emerge where there's been massive investment in renewable energy, including by facilitating the required transmission lines, etc. And the result has been not what they promised. The result has been an almost tripling of power prices, a loss of our industry competitiveness. Yes, the exact opposite. So that should just be judged on that. I mean, as I say, I'm not trying to make this personal, but where's the accountability here? They said that this plan would generate certain benefits. It hasn't. It's been a complete failure. They should go. They should all be sacked, and we should start again. I mean, I had a little bit of exposure to this space when I was resources minister, and I sat on the Ministerial Council on Energy with state and federal ministers, and I do think that at the heart of the problem, Ben, is there are more bodies in this space than a graveyard, and every year you get more of them, the Energy Security Board and all these different groupings, and
review,
they're very good
review
at reports. They write reports and reports and reports and more bureaucracy, and it doesn't generate results. And I just feel that there needs to be a broom swept through. Someone needs to be put in charge to fix things up, as I say, to prioritise. Just set the simple objective that you run the system to generate, obviously, a reliable system. That's number one, of course, and there's all those conditions that we already have in the system, redundancy conditions, unserved energy conditions that need to be set. Set those, you meet those. Your next priority after that, above everything else, is to get the lowest possible power prices. That's what you do. And then if there's space, you look to lower emissions as well. But we are explicitly running the system to meet an emissions target above all else, including reliability, may I add. Yep. If you look at the details of the integrated system plan, their objective is to 82% renewables. Their objective is net zero emissions by 2050. They're inflexible targets. If those meeting those targets, yeah, that's right. Like any optimization problem in engineering and economics, whatever it is, if you set an inflexible target, it's the other objectives then that flex to meet or may have to flex to meet that target. And that's what's happening here, that we are actually, crazily, to put it in its most crazy form, we are willing to compromise on the ability of the lights to stay on to meet an 82% renewable target. What does that mean? Like, what is that going to deliver of any note or benefit to people?
We'll save some emissions if the lights go out. That'll help.
Totally, exactly. Well, it will cause massive heartache. And look, not we shouldn't be trivial about it. People will die. It would appear from early reports that at least five people died in Spain because of their blackout. And so it's very serious. Our economy, our lifestyles are just not set up to withstand large outages of power across an entire massive area. And so we can't afford that to happen. That's why these conditions are in the system. And they previously were sacrosanct and couldn't be compromised. With the addition of these climate targets, they have been. There's no triple bottom line here, but I'm not arguing there should be one. I'm arguing that that reliability should be the first and non-negotiable objective. The second objective should be prices and competitiveness for our own country and industrialization. And then once we've satisfied with that, yes, look at ways of doing things with fewer emissions. I would argue, though, typically, if you're getting the lowest price, you're probably reducing emissions too because you're doing things efficiently. That's how it's worked for a long time. In other systems like Germany, where you've seen them prioritize emissions, you've actually paradoxically often ended up with more emissions because the system becomes so inefficient. You have to bring in diesel and brown coal and average emissions go up.
Yeah, indeed. Now it's a contradiction in terms trying to this trilemma. And I think it was Mr. Turnbull who brought that phrase in, and we've been worse off for it. I think I've always struggled with the idea of the centralized bureaucracy. And a lot of this will be like we started talking about, the people around Rocky don't want the wind farm, but they only get exposed to the decision right at the last minute when they basically got to chain themselves to the trees to stop the project going ahead. Is there a role for maybe a future somewhat sane government to wind back some of this bureaucracy and go to the states? Here, you're a state, you have at it. Leave us alone in federal government. We're not interested in your energy problems.
Yeah, look, I mean, ideally that would be the world you'd operate in. I don't know how we're going to get back to that world. The system's a mess. The Australian people will expect their governments to clean up and fix that mess. I suppose I sometimes view it as similar to the situation after World War II, when Australia did have a fairly precarious power system because then it was too reliant on coal and parts or most of the coal industry was dominated by militant trade unions who often could and did hold governments and industry over a barrel and could at any point in time just shut off the power. And that from that mess, from that vulnerability, grew the Snowy Mountain scheme. That's why the Chifley government, Labor government, principally got behind the Snowy Mountain scheme. If you go back and read the documents and the legislation that established that, it was all about reducing Australia's reliance and vulnerability to coal. It's coal outages, but they were man-made outages when industrial action was taken. Okay. And the federal government stepped in and did that. So the New South Wales and Victorian governments opposed the Snowy Mountain scheme to start with. So if you go and read the legislation, the federal government, the Chifley government, says we're establishing the Snowy Mountain scheme for the defence of Australia. They use the defence heads of power to override the states and get it going. And I think the federal government may have to do something similar in the future because I just can't see the states working this out. That was probably how we were going to have to do the nuclear stuff if we push came to shove. Peter Dutton did say that, look, we'd use all the powers we could to do that. And we may have to in other areas too, because this is a defence issue. I'll come back to the point we've been talking about. It's this lack of energy, lack of gas, is a clear a risk for the defence of our nation and our security, and that is becoming much more vulnerable given the other developments in our region.
Matt, you're for me, you're a beacon of sanity. I think the security problems that these mountains that we're making for ourselves are purely out of our own, you know, stupid imaginations or that of the people who are making the decisions anyway. But yes, it is a big problem. Thank you so much for spending some time with me on Friday afternoon in a wet, drizzly afternoon. I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
No worries, Ben. Have a good one, mate.
You've been listening to the Baseload Podcast. If you like the show, subscribe and tell your friends. Remember, the mailbox is open, thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com.